This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Every week, listeners send us emails not only about our stories, but about the words we use to tell them. Here's one email from Sam Moore of Oklahoma City. Quote, "Every time you refer to President Bush's Social Security reform plan, you are taking part in his propaganda program to sell his plan." And he writes, "Reform suggests it's a needed or desirable change." Now, as media consumers become more conscious of language, we, the providers, get more self-conscious. And that's why we asked Brooke Gladstone, co-host of NPR's On the Media, to look at some of the ways in these politically sensitive times that news outlets decide about words.
Politicians have used words to inspire and seduce since the dawn of nations. Consider the very phrase, Social Security. That program had detractors, but the soothing sibilance of Social Security was music to a nation mired in depression. Back then, the story goes, members of Congress toyed with the phrase economic security, but no, Social Security was best.
From the very beginning, the whole Social Security debate has been caught up in the use of language.
That's Michael Tanner of the Libertarian Cato Institute. He helped shape President Bush's plan to change the program and the language to sell it. Once he liked the phrase private accounts to describe part of that plan, but now the president and much of the media say personal accounts. Tanner says Franklin Roosevelt was just as conscious of the power of words.
Go back even more sort of Orwellian to the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, which is what your Social Security taxes are called. They're certainly not a contribution. They're a tax. And it's not really insurance in any sense of the word. It is simply a tax and a government spending program.
The president wants to change it. He calls it reform. Many in the media have called it reform.
Governor Richardson, on the issue of Social Security reform,
Social Security reform is expected to be a big topic tomorrow in President Bush's State of the Union address.
And Social Security reform. And a lot of Democrats are wondering where you stand on Social Security reform.
Will there be Social Security reform this year?
Of course there will be, because the president is defining this issue. People that define the issue determine the outcome, and the outcome.
You just heard CNN, NPR, ABC, and NBC refer to the president's plan as reform. But several news outlets, including NPR, no longer do.
And Democrats opposed to President Bush's plan to overhaul Social Security say if the
On February 8th, NPR Washington editor Ron Elving sent a memo to staff members instructing them to use more neutral words to describe the president's plan.
Reform, if you look at the dictionary, has a strong implication of improvement. To better something. It's a corrective process.
He suggested some substitutes like
revision or change or revamping or overhaul, retooling.
I refer you then back to your dictionary, Ron, because I looked up overhaul and it means to examine for purposes of repair, very much like reform.
You make a good point, and I would re-examine the use of the term overhaul. I do not think that it contains the same implication that a system has to be improved.
Overhaul is also a word used by the New York Times, but reform is a word with a long political pedigree. The Clinton administration made much of what it called welfare reform, but Elving notes, in that case, reporters invoked the R word liberally.
In part because welfare reform was a cause for President Clinton and a cause for the Republican Congress. So neither side of the partisan divide was absolutely opposed to calling it reform.
Same thing with campaign finance reform. Some members of Congress didn't like it, but it was a bipartisan issue in what was amazing in retrospect, a more bipartisan time. Now, as we are often reminded, we are a nation at war, and yet we struggle for consensus on nearly every issue, including what war we're at.
Our late edition web question of the week asked, is the United States winning the war on terror? Here's how you voted. 8%.
CNN is not unusual among networks in applying the phrase war on terror to a range of government activities, including homeland security, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, and sometimes all of them together. That is, after all, how the president sees it.
Our generational commitment to the advance of freedom, especially in the Middle East, is now being tested and honored in Iraq. That country is a vital front in the war on terror.
But some news outlets, including such newspapers as the New York Times, avoid the phrase or put it in quotes. Frequently, though not always, they separate out Iraq, since many disagree over whether that should be considered part of the war on terror. Randy Weissman is deputy editor of the Chicago Tribune, which has recently revised, or should I say reformed, its style book.
When we're talking specifically about money to fund troops who are going to Iraq, we do not refer to that as the war on terror. But when you talk about the entire budget that Bush is looking for, which covers Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda and intelligence gathering information and the war in Iraq, then that whole thing encompasses the war on terror.
Chicago Tribune public editor Dan Wycliffe notes that in the case of Iraq, events have rendered a once questionable term more accurate.
The fact of the matter is, the war in Iraq now may in fact have become part of the war on terror precisely as a result of our invasion and what has happened since then. So semantics have to reflect the reality properly.
At the Associated Press, reporters rarely invoke the war on terror.
I don't think we use it independently. I think when we use it, we are quoting someone else.
AP Stylebook editor Norm Goldstein.
I think the major question about war on terror, strangely, is whether it should be capitalized or not, and we do not.
He who controls the language controls the debate. Political consultant Frank Luntz is a master of Republican phrasemaking. In a Frontline documentary called The Persuaders, he explained how he sold the idea of cutting the seemingly invulnerable estate tax.
For years, they couldn't eliminate it, but the public wouldn't support it because the word estate sounds wealthy. Someone like me comes around and realizes that it's not an estate tax, it's a death tax, because you're taxed at death. And suddenly, something that isn't viable achieves the support of 75% of the American people.
Mindful of the conscious manipulation, most media outlets resist the death tax. But when the president says it, the media must report it. That's the right of every politician, even Democrats, like Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, who coined his own phrase when commenting on the president's economic policies after the State of the Union address.
After we worked so hard to eliminate the deficit, his policies have added trillions to the debt. In effect, a birth tax of $36,000 on every child that is born.
So, reform versus overhaul, private accounts versus personal accounts, the definition of moral values, the definition of the war on terror. These semantic disputes and many others offer proof positive to both sides that the media are biased. I put the question to Chicago Tribune public editor Don Wycliffe. Do media outlets ever adopt language to prove that they're not, you know, biased? Are changes made in the style book in order to
appease? Absolutely not. No. We have an obligation to reality. We have an obligation to certain journalistic principles like objectivity and verification. The partisans on both sides have no such obligations.
We asked ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, and The Wall Street Journal to comment on their word choices. They all declined. Most news outlets don't have a formal process for dealing with linguistic landmines like reform, but they do read their mail, and they say they respond to suggestions for more neutral terminology. On several issues, though, they disagreed on what that was. That's not surprising. Neutral words turn acid in the crucible of politics. Under the steady gaze of millions of newly minted media critics, even the best-intentioned journalists can and do get burned.
That report comes to us from Brooke Gladstone, co-host of NPR's On the Media, which is produced by WNYC. This is Morning Edition from NPR News.